Hey, Corey here. We've had an influx of new listeners, and so I just want to make sure that if you are new to the podcast, you don't just jump in and start listening to these daily episodes, which we've been doing. Please go back and listen to the first at least 8 episodes so you have an idea of what Collapse is, what it is that Corey is talking about. Also, if you've been with us for a while and you're enjoying the content, please join us on Patreon. We would love to see you there. There's a link, as always, in the description. If you have ever tried to talk to someone else about your belief that society will eventually collapse, you're probably often met with resistance. People push back. They want and need to believe that somebody has everything under control. And oftentimes, especially when we're talking about things like climate change, the ecological situation, biodiversity, resource management, all of those things, they look to scientists. I think one of the issues when it comes to coming to a common consensus on how bad things could really get is that no matter what you believe, you will find someone who claims to be a scientist that will back it up. I mentioned in a recent episode about an acquaintance of mine on Facebook who was certain that the contrails that we see behind airplanes are chemtrails, right? And that those come from geoengineering, so on and so forth. As I had the discussion with her, she continued to send me article after article or documentary or whatever it was with so-called scientists claiming to back up that theory with evidence. The same thing is true with statistics, for example. You can take numbers and you can make them tell you what you want them to say. Why do I bring this up? Well, as we sort of combat climate change, as we combat resource depletion, biodiversity loss, ecosystem destruction, and so on and so forth, there are plenty of people who will downplay it and say those things don't exist and here's the reasons why and here's the scientists that back me up. Then you've got scientists in the middle who will, they have come to a consensus, they've put out their reports, and that may be in the very middle ground, sort of a rational spot to start from. And then you have people or scientists who scream destruction and doom, if you will. That can make it very hard for the average person to know what they should trust. I have had people reach out to me on the podcast, suicidal because Guy McPherson told them that the entire Earth was going to be destroyed by the clathrate gun hypothesis within the next 5 years. And they were telling me, you know, why should I even attempt to continue living? Just absolutely distraught. On other online forums about collapse, you'll see people attempt to claim that, you know, humanity will be extinct by 2040, and laughing at people for pretending like we'll have any society still remaining in a decade from now. And of course, they will have some sort of link or whatever to back their claims. And so everybody's version of what the truth is going to differ. You listening to this may have a very different belief for what the future looks like than I do. You may view the severity very different than I do, for better or for worse. You may look at me and say, Corey is one of those who is he's overstating it way too much. I don't think it's going to be at all as bad as Corey says. Or you may say the opposite and say, Corey's understating it. He's naive and far too hopeful. Now, obviously, I don't talk that much, you know, I don't give predictions about what the future is going to look like and when. Not really. I'm never going to claim to know, you know, the years in which something's going to happen. It's more about sharing what is being said, right? What scientists are saying, what the research is showing, trying to do my own research into that research with an open mind so that I can objectively state, you know, how things appear and what appears to be most likely. So with that, the question might come up, well, why does Corey and why do many people who believe in collapse not follow the most traditional or the most mainstream of scientific consensus around climate change? The IPCC has put out their predictions and their climate modeling and forecasting, which shows a median temperature increase of 2.6 degrees Celsius by the end of the century, by 2100. And if we stop there, that in and of itself is catastrophic. 2.6 degrees by 2100 is life-changing for everyone living through that. Now, there is an issue with using that date, 2100, at least right now, because very few people listening to this podcast will be alive in 2100, right? The kids being born today if life between now and 2100 was relatively normal, meaning lifespans were the same then as they are now, those kids might be in their 70s and 80s and 90s as 2100 rolls around. When we talk about 2100, it's so easy for people to put that off and say, well, then it doesn't matter to me. I won't be here. I don't care if we hit 2.6 degrees Celsius by 2100. We'll only be at 1.8 or 2 by the time I die in 2060 or 2070 or whatever that looks like, right? So that's kind of problem number one. But I just want to point out 2.6 is catastrophic. And that's sort of the trajectory that they say that we're on right now. Well, I believe in a little thing called scientific reticence. And in today's episode, I want to focus a little bit on what scientific reticence is. So we're going to read an article that talks about that specifically. And then we're going to read an article on some new research, a new statement that was released by two different societies in Germany. These are scientific institutions that teamed up together to give their own version of consensus of what the future looks like. And I think that it, in my opinion, tracks closer to what I envision. And their willingness to come out and make this claim, I think, is a step outside of the scientific reticence that we normally see. So with that, let's dive into this reticence article. So this is from Prindle Post. The Prindle Post is a digital publication of public philosophy dedicated to examining the significant ethical issues raised by current events and present in our culture. It is hosted, staffed, and maintained by the Janet Prindle Institute for Ethics at DePauw University. So this article is titled, Why Isn't Everybody Panicking? Scientific Reticence and the Duty to Scare People. This is not a lengthy article, so I'm going to probably read most of it. Bear with me here for a couple of minutes. In 2017, journalist David Wallace Wells published an article, The Uninhabitable Earth, which told a frightening tale of possible scenes from a bad to worst case scenario, outcome of the effects of global warming, ecological degradation, and widespread pollution. Effects ranging from extreme weather, sea level rise, and wildfire to mass migration, food scarcity, and social collapse. It is, I promise, worse than you think, writes Wallace Wells, no matter how well informed you are. The knowledge of how bad it could be has been around for a while. James Hansen first presented the case for possible harms of global warming caused by the burning of fossil fuels to the U.S. Congress in 1988. Given that the scientific evidence has always been out there for anyone to see, even though media reporting has usually been lean, why is it worse than we think? There is an epistemic failure occurring. People in the affluent, industrialized world do not, in general, appear to know how bad the climate crisis is, and do not, in general, appear to appreciate how much worse things will get if we continue to burn fossil fuels and pollute the atmosphere. There are two distinct but related knowledge gaps opening up. Between previous scientific prediction and what is actually happening, and between what scientists know is really happening and what the public thinks. The first problem arises from factors about the nature of climate science itself, like inexactitude of knowledge. We cannot be sure, for instance, what precise degree of warming will result from exactly what new concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And just as an aside really quick, an example of this is measuring climate sensitivity. Sensitivity in the climate is basically what will happen when we double the amount of carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere from pre-industrial averages. So the pre-industrial average was 280 parts per million. Therefore, sensitivity will be once we hit 560 parts per million. And there are all sorts of debates and modeling being done and different ideas about what will the climate be like at that doubling and what degree of warming will we have achieved. Over time, the belief about sensitivity has gotten worse and worse, meaning that in the past it was understated, and they're realizing that as we approach sensitivity, that temperature is going to be higher and the impacts on the climate are going to be worse. So this is an example of the ever-changing and frankly ever-worsening outlook of the climate based on the same numbers that we had before. So we'll come back to this idea in a little bit. Continuing with the article. The world appears to be warming faster as ice melt and other such indicators are accelerating much faster than was predicted only a decade ago. A year ago, scientists concluded that the Earth's oceans were warming 40% faster than previously believed. By the way, this was written in 2020. So when they say 1 year ago, they were referring to the year 2019. The second problem that the public does not really know what scientists know is not simply a problem of dissemination. The possible ramifications from possible physical changes to the environment to the social and humanitarian effects of these does not come straight off the data. It takes interpretation, thought, and imagination. Doubtless, part of the knowledge difficulty, the epistemic deficit is a form of cognitive dissonance. It is hard to imagine the scale of the problem. Climate-induced societal collapse is now inevitable in the near term, writes Professor of Sustainability Jem Bendel. It may be too late to avert environmental catastrophe. Part of the problem is that this does in fact sound like a crazy dystopian fiction. This failure of the imagination is related to the problem of scientific reticence, which some have recently argued is having an adverse effect on policy action, and is even a dereliction of an ethical duty to seriously entertain possible, if extreme, scenarios. Scientific reticence arises both methodologically and stylistically. It takes the form of a tendency to understate the risks of global warming. For instance, much of the scientific modeling, such as that used by the IPCC, has tended to largely underestimate the risks. IPCC climate modeling does not account for tipping points that result in nonlinear, rapid, and irreversible chunks of damage and trigger uncontrollable impacts. Melting sea ice and permafrost are some well-known tipping points. When sea ice melts, temperature rises are compounded by the reduction in reflective surfaces. And when permafrost thaws, large amounts of greenhouse gases will be released and warming will leap. Added to the difficulties of prediction and blind spots in the modeling capabilities is the generally conservative nature of science as a discipline. A great deal of the surrounding scientific literature to emerge over several decades has been conservative in its estimates of effects. That conservatism has meant that scientists are not conveying bad or worst-case scenarios to the public or policymakers. When Wallace Wells published his article, there was some pushback from climate scientists. Some felt that the science was not served by dramatizing the outcomes, and that really dire predictions might undermine scientific integrity with alarmism. There are some signs this attitude is beginning to change, but there are deeply embedded methodological, stylistic, and even ethical reasons for scientific caution. Wallace Wells says that he wrote The Uninhabitable Earth to address the fact that possible worst cases were not being talked about in scientific papers. James Hansen is a notable exception to this, and he has written about the phenomenon of scientific reticence. Drawing attention to the dangers of global warming has at times caused cries of alarmism, and it has been suggested by Hansen that cautious or hesitant predictions are often perceived to carry more authority. The problem is that, now, it is looking like some of those worst-case scenarios are going to be much closer to the truth than the conservative underplay of catastrophe. So I'll stop there for a moment before finishing the article to point out this one, I think, very important aspect of scientific reticence. Essentially, they're saying that if we want people to listen and to believe us, then we need to give a realistic-sounding, conservative answer. If we make it sound alarmist, if we come on too strong, people may discredit it, right? People may very well say, well, if any of this was true, we'd be in a panic, and so these scientists must just be looking for attention, and they can't be credible sources, because not everyone else is saying this. And so everybody kind of stays in line to not be the one publication, the one scientist, the one institute, the one society, whatever it is, to not be Chicken Little screaming that things are worse than they appear. Instead, we get this ever-changing, very slowly growing concern coming out of research where they say, hey, you know, maybe things are a little worse than we expected, and we don't know why, and this is happening faster than we thought, and scientists are baffled. It's like trying to slowly warm the population up to understanding that things are worse than they appear. And in order to maintain this, they do not look at worst case scenarios. That's why every article that you read about climate change at the end has the caveat that we can still slow warming, we can still reverse warming, carbon capture still exists, and new technologies are coming out that could help, and all these types of things that try and leave a positive spin, and they don't want you to be left with a bad taste in your mouth. But like this article says, the problem is that now it is looking like some of those worst-case scenarios are going to be much closer to the truth than the conservative underplay of catastrophe. In any case, it is becoming clear that science has not been effective at communicating the worst risks of climate change. Therefore, those who need to know these possibilities, the public and policymakers, have been ill-informed and ill-served. Once again, stepping outside of the article, this is why people, when they hear about climate change, say it won't be that bad. It's not the end of the world. You're overreacting. Yes, things are going to heat up a little bit. Sea levels will rise some. Sure, the temperature may change slightly. But scientists aren't freaking out, and therefore we don't need to freak out either. Finishing up the last few paragraphs here, it says, in their paper, What Lies Beneath, which explores the failures and blind spots of climate science's understanding of the effects of global warming, Spratt and Dunlop write, "It is now becoming dangerously misleading, given the acceleration of climate impacts globally. What were lower probability, higher impact events are now becoming more likely. Scientific reticence has hindered communication to the public of the true dangers of global warming. This may in turn have directly and indirectly hindered action, which in turn has worsened the problem. Given that the findings of climate science research have existential implications for us, it could be argued that not entertaining the worst potential outcomes is a dereliction of moral duty as well as our duty to science. There is a view that it is dangerous to frighten people too much, that the relevant information and worst risks worth considering are enough to scare the public into a sense of fatalism. Indeed, the news is bad, and at this critical time, resignation may be the last nail in the coffin, so to speak. On ordinary scientific standards, incontrovertible confirmation will happen only when an effect has played out or begun, and it will then be too late to abate it. The central ethical issue here is that ethics seem to be making an unusual demand on scientific communication and on the translation of research data into conclusions needed by the public and policymakers, the demand to be a little more scary. One could argue that man-made effects, which are likely to be harmful, should be treated differently from other types of observations and predictions by virtue of what is at stake, and because caution could in this instance be a vice. People aren't scared enough about global warming. It is, as Wallace Wells says, worse than people think, and though it may not be as bad as his picture, the trend so far points in that direction. Having made that case, though, it must be acknowledged that scientific reticence might be peanuts next to the obfuscations of fossil fuel corporate rapaciousness as a cause of the epistemic deficit our societies are in the hopefully loosening grip of. All right. Apologies if that dragged on. I'm going to link to this, and I think that you should spend some time in it and read it, because there's just lots of little pieces in here, little gems that I think are really critical. Because global warming in the span of a human life is a very slow-moving process, even though from a geological time frame, we're making it happen in the blink of an eye, to the human brain, it feels slow, and it feels so far off into the future. Therefore, it is really hard for a scientist to go out of his way to claim some, you know, really scary, tragic future when people look around them and see that everything, at least maybe in their own personal life, seems fine. They see on the news, floods and worsening weather and issues with sea level rise somewhere else. And they say, well, this has always been happening. There have always been floods. There have always been droughts or famines. This is nothing different. It's just what we're seeing in the moment. And they'll say news coverage is increasing. And so, of course, we're going to be seeing it more often. And in many cases, that is true. Of course, we are seeing it more often. 50 years ago, this was not being shown on the news because 50 years ago, we did not have the news coverage that we have today, right? But when climate change makes a certain event, an event that was a 1-in-1,000-year event, right, now become a 1-in-10-year event. When climate change makes another event 30% more likely or causes other things to happen 40% more frequently. And when that happens over a decade or two decades, right, it is a very hard thing to be able to pinpoint specifically as a scientist and say, see, this is what I'm saying. This is what I told you. And so they don't. They're still claiming tragedy. 2.6 degrees by 2100 is not acceptable. The Paris Climate Accord, the whole goal was to keep it below 1.5 degrees by 2100. And as a worst case scenario, to keep it below 2, acknowledging that hitting 2 would still lead to catastrophic changes globally. Now we're on track to hit 2.6, and according to the IPCC, and the reality is much worse than that, most likely. So, like I mentioned, let's look at a couple of scientists or a couple of scientific societies that came out and said, look, looking at some of the worst case scenarios, we actually believe that we're headed towards something worse than what's being presented. And again, in a worst case scenario, potentially much worse than what is being presented. Catastrophically worse. Two of the scientists, one from each of those societies, joined an organization called World Crunch for an interview to talk about this this new research and this new statement that these societies have made. So the title of the World Crunch article is Global Warming at 3 Degrees Celsius by 2050? What's behind the new German climate warning? German scientists warn global warming is accelerating faster than expected, raising the risk of a 3 degrees Celsius rise by 2050 and forcing Europe to confront unthinkable adaptation plans. So again, these two societies are the German Physics Society and the German Meteorological Society. They released a joint statement. It is quite lengthy, the whole paper, so I won't be going through it all. But I'll be hitting some of the main points here, and I will also be reading clips from this interview that was done. The two scientists here who were being represented in this interview are Frank Böttcher, which I'm sure I'm saying that incorrectly, and Klaus Richter. Now, the interviewer asks this question. He says, the professional associations of meteorologists and physicists in Germany warn that the Earth could have warmed by 3 degrees Celsius by 2050. That's only 25 years away. Do you really think that is realistic? Their responses are, the risk is increasing that we will miss the goal of keeping global warming below 2 degrees Celsius. We believe the trend towards a 3 degrees Celsius rise can no longer be ruled out, especially given current global politics. We therefore call for decisive action and stronger climate protection to minimize this risk. Frank responded, we have entered a new stage of climate change. Global warming now appears to be accelerating. We see it here in Germany too. The data is so compelling that members of our societies felt they had a duty to speak out despite all the uncertainty and the usual caution. So there, talking about the usual caution, he is of course referring to scientific reticence. The interviewer asks, that forecast is far more dramatic than current research. Taking climate policies into account, most projections put warming at about 2.7 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. By 2050, that would be roughly 2 degrees Celsius. How do you reach 3 degrees Celsius by 2050? Klaus said, we are looking 25 years ahead and beyond, so this is not a forecast in the strict sense, but current observations give reason to fear that such extreme warming is possible. The 2.7 degrees Celsius projection is based on the IPCC's mid-range scenarios. The risk of 3 degrees Celsius by 2050 falls within their worst-case scenarios, and unfortunately, recent data aligns more closely with those. The interviewer asks, did the IPCC underestimate the situation? Frank responds, the last IPCC report is now a decade old. The data looks very different today. We see a clear acceleration in warming. The half-degree steps are coming faster and faster. Then there is the issue of ocean temperatures. Oceans have long been a massive buffer against warming, but for 2.5 years now, we have seen a sharp spike. If this continues, the oceans will absorb less of the extra energy caused by greenhouse gases, and temperatures in the atmosphere will climb faster. The interviewer responds and says, 2.5 years is a short period. Is that enough to draw such conclusions? Klaus says, the rise in ocean temperatures fits a broader pattern, as several indicators point to an acceleration of climate change. Around 15 scientists from our two societies spent 18 months compiling current findings. They debated, for example, whether the sharp rises in global temperature in recent years was just statistical noise or whether they reveal a clear trend. New studies suggest climate sensitivity may be higher than thought, meaning the same amount of CO2 raises temperatures more than we assumed. This backs the idea that a trend exists. All right, I'm not going to read the entirety of this article. It basically goes on to say, what would 3 degrees Celsius of warming mean in 25 years? What would the world look like? They give a few responses about the change in vegetation, rainfall patterns, how much of Spain, right, they're speaking specifically for Europe here, would look more like the Sahara Desert. For Germany, it could mean temperatures in excess of 50 degrees Celsius, more severe drought. At the end, though, there's an interesting question that I want to highlight, and it comes back to the scientific reticence question. Can you still get this message across, especially now when climate change barely features in politics or public debate? Frank said, we wrestled with that. None of us wants to be accused of alarmism, but the data has pushed so many of us to speak up. As a result, for the first time since 1987, our two societies reached a broad consensus. Klaus responds and said, Germany's new federal government has said little so far about climate policy, but maybe now is the right moment to put it back on the agenda. Our climate future is not an unavoidable fate we must resign ourselves to. And he later refers to the idea that while much of the warming is baked in, we can affect policies and changes, and the amount of emissions can affect how much warming we're going to see. But I thought it was interesting here because he's hitting on two points. Part of this is the reticence, and they don't want to be accused of alarmism, and they wrestled with how they should release this information. They had to make a decision. Do we give in to scientific reticence and just toe the consensus line and not deviate from that so as not to appear as doomers or alarmist or whatever? We don't want to be discredited. We don't want our societies to be demonetized and accused of whatever, right? So they had to wrestle with that, and they made the decision to release this. But the other part of this is that the questioner is sort of highlighting, the interviewer is highlighting how climate change is not really in politics anymore. It's not part of the conversation. It's not in public debate. Why is that? As things are accelerating and getting worse, why are we talking about it less and less? And I think that one of the many reasons for that is scientific reticence. It's gotten boring and bland, and people have found the excuse that it's okay because, again, it's not an immediate problem in my lifetime. Now, the last question that was asked, you also call for, quote, ensuring that society is provided with science-based information. Is that under threat? Klaus says yes, in some parts of the world. Our colleagues in the United States in particular are under heavy pressure, especially in climate science. But limiting global warming requires the input of nearly every scientific discipline in dialogue with society, far beyond the natural sciences. So, in the end, are we headed for a world that is 3 degrees Celsius warmer by 2050, just 25 years from now? I think of the last 25 years, from 2000 to 2025. The 1850 to 1900 baseline showed a change of 0.7 degrees from about 0.8 degrees Celsius in 2000 to 1.5 in 2025. Now, if we just extrapolate that out linearly, right, then by 2050, we grow by another 0.7. There alone, we're at 2.2. As these two societies are pointing out, the climate modeling currently does not take into account acceleration in climate change due to feedback loops, due to tipping points. We are currently, as we speak, breaching those tipping points. We are on the verge, likely in the next decade or so, of having our first ice-free winter or summers, excuse me, in the Arctic. The decrease in albedo will cause an ever-growing amount of warming in those big blue ocean waters. As permafrost continues to melt, permafrost, which has not melted for millennia, that will rapidly release more greenhouse gases, which will, in turn, heat the planet up more, which will, in turn, increase the rate at which permafrost melts. The same thing can be said of melting glaciers, right? Or of sea ice in Antarctica. The same can be said of our carbon sinks turning into carbon sources, the savannification of the Amazon. As the oceans warm and they are able to contain less and less of the carbon and less of the warmth entering the planet, that will relocate to other parts of the planet. As the AMOC slows down, as it shuts down, tipping point after tipping point. These are changes that the planet is currently undergoing. And in the coming decades, like these scientists, I believe that we will start to see this fed more and more into climate models. And those models will start to project scenarios much worse than the ones that they have currently projected. Most of those scenarios that the IPCC has bake in pledges and promises, goals, which will reduce the amount of emissions that countries are making. And while some of them over time may reduce the carbon emissions, none of them seem to be on track to actually hit their goals. But even with a reduction, hitting sort of that net zero is seeming increasingly unlikely or further and further away. Yes, we are moving more towards renewable energies, but up to this point, we still have not seen an overall decrease in the amount of emissions. Year after year, new records are hit for the amount of emissions, and it's yet to be seen when that supposed first year will come that our emissions decrease. Anyway, I think reticence will always be there. There will always be this pressure, especially from political organizations, state entities, to downplay the threats, so to not scare people, to keep people buying, to keep investors investing, right? Corporations, especially those involved directly in fossil fuel industry, are going to continue lobbying and making it hard for scientists to be able to speak freely about how the future looks. That baseline scenario is going to continue to get worse and worse as things continue to happen faster than expected. And it becomes undeniable that we'll blow past 1.5, that we'll blow through 2, and that we potentially head towards 3 degrees Celsius by 2050. Is it a given? No, that may not happen. These scientists here are even saying it's just a scenario that we simply cannot refute. We cannot pass it by and say that, it can't happen. And we have to admit that it's becoming more and more likely. In the end, the truth is scientists don't know everything. There's too much. There's too much complexity. There are too many factors. that we don't have all of the data for. But the point of today's episode is to simply say that taking the available evidence that we do have and using the most conservative estimate based off of that is probably not wise for humanity in the long run. All right. Sorry, I know this was quite a bit longer. Thank you for being here. We'll see you next time. Hey, Corey here. If you are listening to the back catalog of Breaking Down Collapse, thank you. Those episodes are so vital. They're so important. But I also wanted to let you know that I am now doing daily episodes. Yes, that's right. Here on the podcast, daily episodes. So if you are enjoying the back catalog, great. Please also feel free to zoom forward to the most recent episodes. Catch us daily. They are quick little episodes, and I think you'll enjoy them. Thanks.